And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Larry.
Clue season.
Yes, Dean Haglund, you are correct. It is cold and flu season. Everybody else, this is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. And
hooray!
I am Phil Larinus. That is Dean Haglund.
Hi, everybody. Listen to that audio quality.
Yes, every so often, Dean will just break in with a reminder for you to check the audio quality. We were discussing the fact that I'm playing hurt today. I've just flown back cross country, a whirlwind trip to the East Coast for a funeral. And, you know, and I brought back a nice head cold with me, carried it right onto the plane. I did.
That's smart.
Which I was unable to do with my chill pack on the way there. Can you believe this?
Well, technically, this is the first I've heard of a chill pack being confiscated. But looking at the TSA website, I guess theoretically it's a gel.
Exactly. So, it's a gel and they can't test it, is what they say.
Right.
And Lily was outraged. I mean, I even said to them as they, you know, check my bag and check this, you know, I have carried this on every trip for almost 20 years now. And they said, we can tell.
What?
Because it's been used so much.
Oh, I see. I get it. Yeah.
And it was infuriating because, you know, I don't know if you're aware of this, Dean. They don't make more of these anymore.
Yeah. No, I am aware of this. And I do maybe have a replacement for you.
Well, okay.
Through my creative endeavors. That's all I'm saying.
Because I know people. I'm kind of a big deal. I own a lot of leather-bound books, but it's not that they didn't believe me. They did believe me and offered me the opportunity to go back down and check it. But that was no opportunity because by that point, after waiting for the bag check for so long with TSA. My choice was I could go and check it or I could catch my flight.
Well, those are two tough choices, I think.
And Lily was, I mean, she was a mama grizzly ready to protect her young and not what you want at that moment, actually, because she is pointing out the flaws in their system left, right, and center in terms of, you know, like the why did you let the woman in front of him who had the big cracked plastic bottle of blue liquid that was taped up and wrapped in a Wonder Bread bag, which is what it was. And all you did was hold it up and look at the Wonder Bread bag. And they said, well, it was NyQuil. And she said, and Lily said, the woman said it was NyQuil, but how do you know? And they said, well, ma'am, we could have tested that. Could have, but didn't. We can't test this, but you're not testing anything. She was outraged. And so I had to.
Well, you know, there's some logic to that, I suppose. Well, no. What are you going to do?
I will say this, though, and I don't know. There's people out there who travel more than I do, who are smarter about these things than I am, I'm sure. But I have been hearing some really, not treacherous exactly, but some hairy TSA and security check stories of late, especially people coming out to the wedding. And they always, 100% of the time, involve people flying into or out of American Airlines terminals.
Oh.
And I always thought that TSA guidelines were the same no matter what airline you were flying.
I thought so too.
But I will say that this was American, and I've only experienced things like this on American. And I always avoided American because American's quite frankly the fucking worst.
Yes.
It's horrible. It's always, I think once, you know, every 10 years or so, I think, okay, I'll fly American. And it's, you know, Jesus.
It's a terrible experience.
It's Voyage of the Damned. And but enough about that. I will say this, though, about flying cross-country now, and I don't know, again, you're a more seasoned traveler than I am, but I've always been used to the, the flight back there, it's fine, the challenge is, you know, depending on when you fly, you get off the plane, you've lost 3 hours, people pick you up at night, they're ready to go to bed, and you just want to go out at that point, you know?
That's right.
But flying back here, the cool thing is the flight's faster and you get 3 extra hours, which is cool. But something strange is going on where now all the flights heading west are facing headwinds. And they're setting records for the longest amount of time it takes. I mean, this flight from D.C., from L.A. to D.C., 4.5 hours. That was ridiculously short for that flight. From D.C. to L.A., 6.5 hours in the air.
You know, that jet stream that shifted and made the polar vortex happen, that has some real gust to it. And in fact, one of the records is a flight that went from, I forget where, but landed in London, and they were going over 800 miles an hour because that jet stream behind them was pushing them so fast. So they got to London in like 6 hours, a record, fastest flight ever. So what's freezing our buns off is also speeding up our plane.
Or slowing it down. I mean,
or slowing it down, depending on which you're going.
But it all still relates to what we can call climate change, environmental changes, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
And the same person, now I'm not going to say that he's an absolute authority. I haven't checked his bona fides, but I know him. I like him. He's going to be running for Congress. And he's the person that actually told me, and I'm going to look into it, that yes, indeed, airlines with their own terminals do have the ability to dictate a little bit how, some of these TSA rules are enforced. And American is apparently quite sensitive to this because of their track record. So anyway, I don't know. Take that for what it's worth. But he had a great point, which is, you know, he's so tired of how every topic, and this is right in our wheelhouse, but every topic gets depicted and talked about, not only dealt with, but talked about on the left, the far left, and the right. You know, how people dig in on their positions. And he took climate change as an example, you know, and how the de rigueur way to attack this issue on the left is to deal with it as a moral issue, that saving the planet is a moral issue. And he pointed out something that a long time ago, George Carlin kind of referenced, which is, it's the dumbest thing to tell people that our moral imperative is to save the planet. The planet will be here.
Right.
It's people that are fucked. So the point of it is, we need to save ourselves.
Right.
We need to save our ways of life. And this is the thing, right? The states so often that are represented, the people who deny climate science, their populace is often the population bases that are being affected the most by these terrible storms. And so we don't even need to deal with anymore. It seems to me, okay, was it man-made? Was it not man-made? Was it? It's what the fuck are we going to do to preserve healthy ways of life?
Yes. And this is, you know, the thing when the inversion happened in London in 1952 and everybody was covered in smog and Winston Churchill refused to do anything about it, saying it's weather. It's weather that you can't do anything about. And that became the very basis of the environmental movement as we know it today. So, you know, you have a long legacy of people just going and shrugging their shoulders, going, there's nothing you can do about it.
So from the depressing to the ultra depressing, I went to a I went to a funeral this weekend for Lily's Aunt Florence. This is her father's sister, the next to last of that generation in the family. She was very much the matriarch, we can say, in the Washington area. She had been in a memory ward for some time, and therefore obviously was not able to attend the wedding, but was very much a part of it. And, you know, that veil, that 20-foot veil that Lily wore.
Right.
I don't know if it's 20. It was long. It was really long.
It was long.
I mean, we both had to wrap it around our arms when the wedding staff failed to come and remove it from her right before our first dance, which had been arranged. So it was a long veil. And she was the 20th bride to wear that veil, to be married in that. And the first one was Aunt Florence. Loved Aunt Florence. She was such a keen mind, such a probing mind, but also just a person of great faith, a fount of just love and devotion. Just adored Lily. And one story real quick. I remember we were at Lily's brother's 40th birthday. This was several years back, and at the Chevy Chase Club in Washington D.C. there, and I was dancing with Aunt Florence, and she said, "This is so much fun. We must do this again." And I said, "Well, someday, Florence, I'll dance with you at my wedding to Lily." And she said, "It's a date." And so I feel like I had that dance with Florence, even
though
she could not attend the wedding. So what was cool about it, Dean, was it was everything I think we both would say we want to see from some kind of ritual like this, which namely, it was a celebration not only of a life well lived, but a celebration of what she stood for, what she meant, so that all that she was and all that she is can continue to plant seeds and influence and inform the lives of others.
Ah, well, that sounds like a good funeral then.
Yeah, it really was cool. And it's the two things, the two takeaways are some people feel the need at the beginning and at the end of, you know, when they're saying, "Oh my goodness, it was so wonderful to see you. I'm so glad you came." They feel the need to couch it with, "I mean, I know it's for a horrible experience, or I know it's for a sad reason, but," and it's like, you know, I don't think we need to say those things. If it's wonderful to see someone, it's wonderful to see someone celebrating life. That's what we're doing. We're celebrating life. And we should never, apologize about celebrating things.
Exactly.
And especially for Florence, because Florence was someone, as all people, I think, of real deep moral philosophy and experience in life, realized that all of joy is tinged with sorrow. All celebration is tinged with sorrow, because we know that everything we love and everything we celebrate will end. And that's built into the mix. And that's what makes it so important to celebrate these things.
Exactly. It's a full circle, like you said.
I do also come away really realizing, you know, there's movies that we've loved, like Away From Her and Amour. But there are no shortage of stories to tell about this issue that is confronting, I think, society writ large which is, you know, memory loss. And
right.
Because it's just a growing, I don't want to say phenomenon exactly, but that's almost what it feels like, right? It affects more and more people. And not only the people who are losing memory or having their memory changes, but the loved ones around them. And it's a really interesting mirror for people and for society, I think.
Well, yeah, because this is also, there's two types of categories. One is Alzheimer's and one is dementia. And both of those have clinical prognosis, solutions, and therapies to it. So, but yeah, is it on the increase? I don't know the stats on it off the top of my head. Or if I do, I forgot them.
You forgot them. Well, there certainly also is the issue, I think, of, you know, how you see people approach this. And often it falls into one of two categories, which is we either approach the people who are entering this kind of memory loss or experiencing it as having lost who they were because we've lost who they were to us.
Right.
Or they've lost us or who we were to them, right? That's how we approach it. Or there's others who say, no, they're still the same people. They're the same people without that memory. You know, so what do we identify with? And then we project it onto other people. So it's fascinating. And I'm going to do some writing about it. And who knows? I mean, this is a worthy avenue of exploration. We do have, though, so many celebrity deaths we will get to a little later. Though, Dean, we will not be taking the time to cover the passing of Jerry Merriman, the co-inventor of the pocket calculator, because police say his death just didn't add up. Okay.
Now I have a head cold.
And that is my segue into Dean Haglund talking about whether he has set up any future comedy dates.
Say, have I or have I not? Let's see. We are going to be Rhode Island. April 26th, 27th, and 28th.
Oh, are you going to do comedy there?
I have thought I might. They seem to have an evening planned of stuff. I haven't actually firmed that up, but you know, I'm willing to do comedy at the drop of a hat. Also here in the Detroit area, I'm going to be start popping up at some of the free for alls, some of the open mics, some of the things where microphones and audiences stand together, and I will then be standing in amongst that doing whatever I do. So nothing booked per se that I can firm up other than Rhode Island.
So people can, check that out. April 26th, 27th, 28th. It is an X-Files convention. It's X-Filers United in Warwick, Rhode Island. The Truth Is Out There is going to be screened. I might even drop because we got 4 hours booked for that screening, which means, you know, 2 hours and 20 minutes for that movie. We'll do a panel, do a little dog and pony show. I might even bring a little teaser reel for part two.
Wow, look at you. Wouldn't that be something?
Wouldn't it be
something? And of course, in June, of course, it's the X-Files convention fan run in Chelmsburg, Illinois. That's the big X-Fest. I'll be at that one, of course, as well.
X-Fest 2.
X-Fest 2. I know. It's the second one. I missed the first one because of my time in Australia, but everybody said it was fantastic. And so looking forward to this one.
Well, you did cast a shadow over that thing, though. I mean, we did podcast reports relating to that. Remember? I mean, we had guests.
I do, yes.
So
it was, people reported to us how fun it was. So, yeah, guess we'll have to do that again.
All right. I had some movies to talk about, but maybe save them for the end, unless there's anything you've seen that you want to talk about. But otherwise, we got bodies piled up in the hall.
Let's do the bodies.
All right. Let me drop in a little theme that we like to call celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
Dean, Liza Sheridan died at her apartment in New Orleans at age 44. Cause of death not known, I believe, at this time, though I took these notes a while ago. Liza Sheridan was an actress known for her roles in Halt and Catch Fire, which I've never seen, and Invasion. She attended the Carnegie Mellon School of Drama in Pittsburgh. She had a main role on the Fox sci-fi series Freaky Links. Did you ever watch that?
Oh, yeah. You know, that was how many seasons did that get? One or two?
I don't know. You got to tell me. I mean, because you were in the stable of Fox sci-fi TV actors.
Well, absolutely. When the X-Files broke large, there was suddenly a whole bunch. There's Dark Skies, Earth 2, Freaky Links. They even tried to do Blair Witch Project as a TV series, thinking they'd get that horror TV crossover. So a lot of those things came out in that time, and they were hard to watch all of them. Some of them, you know, I'm not going to use the word derivative at this point, to not be without specifying which project is derived from which, but I didn't watch Freaky Links as a regular viewer.
She was also a guest star in many TV shows, including Monk, NCIS, and Scandal. Wow. And I love seeing the words NCIS and Scandal right next to each other, since NCIS is plagued with scandal, as are so many CBS shows now, from sexual harassment. Showrunner, right? You saw NCIS New Orleans got removed from the show because of a long history of... You know, you're at a network run by Les Moonves. I'm shocked to find that there would be sexual abuse and harassment covered up on a show. Liza Sheridan in the 2000s, early 2000s, was engaged to actor Ron Livingston. So when she was quite young, apparently they got disengaged because it doesn't say they got married, and she died at 44.
Wow, that's young.
At 64, Mark Hollis, he was the co-founder, lead singer, guitarist, and principal songwriter of one of Dean Haglund's favorite 1980s British synth pop bands, Talk Talk.
Oh, right. I don't know if it was my favorite British synth pop band, but Talk Talk, yes.
They were so good that they were named twice, Talk Talk. The band was popular during the early MTV New Wave era with the hit songs Talk Talk. And see, that's what I loved. I loved back then how so many bands would have, their big hit song would be the name of the band. Like, remember Big Country from Big Country, the album In a Big Country? It was so... Anyway, and that sounds like...
I do remember that.
That sounds like I'm joking, and I'm not. I wish You're I could not. Come up with something that good. Anyway, they also had the big hit, kind of, I don't know, it's sort of iconic. It's My Life. They moved to new romantic art rock for their 1985 album, The Color of Spring. And I don't know if I would necessarily know the difference between new wave British synth pop and new romantic art rock, other than the fact that you have the word color in the title with a U in there. So that's...
Well, that's a dead giveaway. Could be Australian, though.
It included the hit Life's What You Make It. In 1988... taking so much joy. I think Mark Hollis would appreciate me celebrating his obituary like this. In 1988, the band released the critically acclaimed but commercial flop Spirit of Eden, a highly influential, pioneering post-rock record. So I already like them from learning about this guy because, boy, they were committed to reinventing themselves. How many people try to recreate what worked? And here was a band and a man who was committed to, okay, we did that. It worked. Let's try something else. And I always admire that. Hollis released one solo album after the band broke up in 91, then left the music industry, retreating from the public eye. So really, Dean, if he was no longer in show business, it's more or less like he died in 1991.
No, because that's what matters. Is that what you're saying?
I am saying it. I'm not meaning it. I'm expressing a jaded viewpoint of how often these things get depicted, right? Which is
right. One of the reasons
we have celebrity deaths in the first place, because it's so much more sad when a celebrity dies than when an ordinary person dies. It's as if we lost two people.
I guess. Yeah, sure. No. Okay.
All right. No, if anything, no. We do this because it's an opportunity to learn. And like we always say, it's so easy for people to get fixed in the public consciousness with one thing or maybe two things. And like we just learned, you know, people are constantly motivated at their best to reinvent themselves and to discover new things. And just because those new things maybe weren't as popular doesn't mean that they weren't as significant in some ways or as interesting. Like this album that they did, a huge flop, and yet highly influential.
Meaning that just other bands bought it.
Yeah.
And, well, there you go. Fantastic.
Yeah, highly, I like it. Highly, maybe the influence was it convinced people not to reinvent themselves. All right.
Right. What a mistake.
Geraldine Saunders, Dean Haglin. Now, this is a name I knew actually through the Breakfast Club because she had presented before I ever became a member. But I had heard people, some of the older members always said, why don't we get her back? Why don't we get her back? So, Dean, Geraldine Saunders, this is gonna make you laugh. This is going to make you smile.
Okay.
Who do you think Geraldine Saunders was? So you already know L.A. area. She lived in Glendale. A woman of a certain age for them to be inviting her to the Breakfast Club at that time. What do you think?
Right.
Take a guess.
I'm going to musical. She's a singer, a chanteuse. A chanteuse of some renown.
Okay, not a bad guess. She was the creator of the ABC television series, The Love Boat.
Yeah, really?
Yes.
Wow.
It began with a made-for-TV movie based on her 1974 nonfiction book, Love Boats. In her book, she shared anecdotes of her time as a cruise director. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm getting it. I'm seeing where this book is going. I'm seeing big things.
Yeah, well, no, exactly. Like that's actually really, really interesting. And I mean, how responsible, at least indirectly, was she for the burgeoning cruise scene? I mean, that industry exploded.
No, yeah, it blew up from that show. Are you kidding? That was that was the only reason everybody started taking cruises again, with the hopes of Shaq hooking up with Barbie Benton.
Oh my God! I would sign up for that cruise. Yeah, I mean,
I know, right?
Are the Landers sisters not available? Charo?
Charo. Okay. Yeah.
Yes, so Barbie Benton. Oh my God, you pulled that out! Wow, Barbie Benton for the win.
For the win.
Let me see. But there's also something really fascinating about her. So she was also a writer, obviously, cruise director turned writer. But she wrote, and I don't know if you remember this. I don't peg you as someone who is necessarily ever been really interested in astrology, but maybe I'll find out something different. But in my formative years, used to regularly read a certain astrological column, and it was Omar's Astrological Forecast.
Okay.
And it was created by Geraldine Saunders' former husband, Sidney Omar. But Geraldine Saunders wrote the column.
Oh, you're kidding. That's fantastic. Did she have astrological training? Did she know her Mars retrograde from her Pluto and Goofy?
Well, he claimed to be the astrological expert, and he claimed to be writing it. So I don't know. If ghost written, I'm going to bet there was a lot of looking up in encyclopedia, and I don't know. I really don't know.
Oxygen will play a big part in your day today, Leo. Okay. Fantastic.
Oh, my God. That's great. Oh, my God. I want you to write a Chilpak Horoscope.
Horoscope. Oh my gosh. Friday, they expect a big surprise.
Oh, don't enter into any lifelong contracts this week, Aries.
Okay. Yeah. Check mark.
Yep. No, don't enter into any 1,000-year service contracts that pay you $1, Scientologists. All right.
Yeah, don't do that.
Okay. So she's dead at 95 years of age. So she was a contemporary of so many of the Breakfast Clubbers that Lily met when she first discovered the club.
Right.
All right. Character actor Morgan Woodward. This guy was always a little bit creepy. Such a good character actor. He played the menacing field boss in the classic The Man. The menacing field boss who was called simply The Man with No Eyes. In the classic Cool Hand Luke.
Oh, him, yes. With the reflective glasses.
Exactly.
That always were so shiny. And you could see everybody working on the chain gang while he stood there with his gun over his shoulder.
I mean, what an impact, right? While remaining completely silent while overseeing the chain gang. Now, he was a fixture in many Western series, especially, not surprisingly, including Gunsmoke and Bonanza. I probably first knew him. You know, I'm doing a spoken word thing tonight over Rant and
Rave. Oh, yeah, is that
at Rogue Machine, yeah. And the theme is Shatter, and I misheard. So I've got so much, I'm not joking, I have so much about Shatner, William Shatner, and I am not about to let my research go to waste. So that's going to prove interesting and potentially problematic. Anyway, the point is
fantastic
that Morgan Woodward had two memorable roles in the original Star Trek TV series, appearing in the episodes Dagger of the Mind, and where I think he played... I don't know what he played. And but the Omega Glory, where he played another ship captain, and that is maybe the best worst episode of Trek, because it's the one where Shatner gets to read the preamble to the Constitution at the end.
Oh, yes. You know,
The yangs and the comms.
I
did not recognize it because you spoke the word so badly. That which you call e plebnista is really we. The people. All
right. That's very good. Yeah. Was that the one where they all went bonk, bonk, bang, bang? No, that was a different one.
That's Miri.
Okay.
So,
got it.
That's what I know him for. He also played the popular character Punk Anderson on the primetime soap opera Dallas. And I remember him from that as well.
Look at that.
Yeah.
Another
perfect... role for that guy. Morgan Woodward, a fixture at fan conventions, at autograph shows. I would see him from time to time. Dead at 93. Also dead at 93 is Mack Weissman. He was a bluegrass legend known as the voice with a heart. I'm going to start using that for you. Dean Haglund, the voice with a heart.
Voice with a heart.
Right before I introduce you for your monthly astrological report.
Yes, please do. That'd be classic.
Now, you'll know some of these names. The singer guitarist Big Break came when he was asked to join the Foggy Mountain Boys. He moved on to Bill Monroe's Bluegrass Boys, singing on the classic Can't You Hear Me Calling. He had a long solo career that included the hit song Jimmy Brown, The Newsboy, and worked with artists of various genres, get this, including John Prine and funk master Bootsy Collins.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's quite a range.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But... indeed. I mean, if you're great at the blues, I'm hazarding a guess there's probably nothing you can't do.
That's right. Yeah, you know your chords.
Yeah, I mean, it's the underpinning of so much great American music. Not far away from the home of the blues is Nashville, TN. Dead at 78, Dean Haglund, is Jackie Shane. Now, Jackie Shane has quite a Canadian connection.
Really?
So I'm relying on you as both a pioneering Canadian in your own right, as well as a long-standing fan of transgendered soul music.
Right. I'm not saying no. What are you talking about?
Dean Haglund, the voice with a heart. I want to be like the voice with a body. Okay. So she was a pioneering transgendered soul singer who became a star in Toronto, Canada in the 1960s.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
With a show called Night Train.
Is that right?
Yeah. There was a show. I never watched it because a little bit before my time, but I remember seeing historical things of Canadian television, and there was always Night Train was a breakthrough series with the Jackie. I don't know any of her music, but now that you said that, it sort of went, oh yeah. Yeah, there was that show out of Toronto.
So she came back to prominence recently. Interesting when record label Numero Group released an album of her singles and live recordings, and the album was nominated for a Grammy for Best Historical Album. She started her music career in Nashville, makes sense, but she left for Canada to escape Jim Crow laws, and she packed nightclubs in Toronto. But she abruptly left show business in 1971 to come back to the States in order to take care of her mother. But like I said, she saw a career revival. She saw herself rediscovered through this reissue of her historic recordings. Jackie.
Wow. I didn't know the Grammys had a historical recording category.
Well, you learn something new. This is why we do Celebrity Deaths, because we are soft pedaling so many different course curriculums into this little category, Celebrity Deaths. Tell me there is not a Jackie Shane biopic worthy
in the
of
world.
Being made. I mean, come on.
I'm
now.
Saying, come on. How can that not be?
Jim,
the exciting 6 years.
The 60s.
Yes.
Nashville. You know, Music Row. Toronto. Yeah. Jim Crow laws. Transgendered issues. My God in heaven, what more do you need?
I know. The show writes itself.
All right. Which is why neither of us are writing it.
Exactly. We don't have to.
All right. We didn't talk about this either. I mean, a lot of people were a little surprised by this, knowing what a huge influence, a shadowy influence he was upon us. It would have taken but a nudge to make us exactly like this man. Peter Tork of the Monkees died at 77 years of age.
Yeah, that's right. How little of a nudge would it have been for us to have been Peter Tork?
Well, he was the lovable wise guy of the Monkees.
Oh, I see. Of the Monkees, right.
The popular television rock group that rocketed to stardom in the 1960s. He was, people don't remember this, he was a serious musician who pushed for the Monkees to create their own music instead of the outside musicians and songwriters the producers used when the show started. I mean, he was working as a session musician. He was the real deal when he got when he auditioned and was cast for it.
Right. One of the few.
He co-wrote the song For Pete's Sake, which was used for the closing credits during the Monkees' second season. He continued to record and perform folk and blues music after the Monkees, releasing his latest album with his band Shoe Suede Blues in 2018. Dean, were the Monkees a big deal in Canada?
They were, actually. Yeah, the series did very well there. I mean, you know, the older siblings had control of the television, so I watched it and dug the crazy comedy and the wild Dutch angles of every scene basically had the camera tilted to the left or right somehow. But the Monkees. Hey, we're the Monkees. People say we monkey around.
Did you ever see the Bob Rafelson movie written by Nicholson?
Okay. With Jack Nicholson and that crazy thing.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if that's a comedy though. Would you call Head a comedy?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm
really trippy.
I'm just asking.
But anyway, yes. Yes. The monkeys.
Peter Tork, 77. King Kong Bundy was 61 years of age. He was a professional wrestler, one of the WWE's most legendary villains. Born Chris Pallies, he wrestled under other names during his early professional days, including Chris Canyon and Big Daddy Bundy. He was known, not surprisingly, for his massive size and for signature moves, including his avalanche splash. Oh, that sounds delicious, actually.
That does. I'm really thirsty for an avalanche splash right about now.
He battled Hulk Hogan for the WWF World Heavyweight Championship in a steel cage match at 1986's WrestleMania II. Bundy lost, but continued wrestling up until his 2007 retirement. King Kong Bundy. So, WWE, WWF, popular in Canada?
yeah. You know, as a kid, I remember being on the receiving end of many a move I didn't watch it, but I had to watch it in order to figure out how to defend myself from the splashing avalanche.
Exactly. All right. We are jumping all over the celebrity map this time.
Okay.
Luke Perry.
I know.
Achieved superstardom as the teen heartthrob Dylan McKay on the hit 1990s drama Beverly Hills 90210. I'm not proud of myself that the night before he died, I was saying 9021. Oh, my God. I had a stroke. I did.
Oh my God, that's horrible.
And I confess it, and I really didn't realize, you know, look, he's the age my sister was when she had a stroke. And I didn't realize how much more dangerous strokes are the younger you are.
Yeah. Because it's harder to recover.
Well, the brain. So this is the thing, is that the stroke seemed mild when he first had it. And it got but the damage from it got worse and worse and worse because of the bleeding, and the brain swelling and all of this. Apparently, all of that is so much more dangerous for younger people than older people. Of course, 90210 was Aaron Spelling's big hit show about teens navigating life in Beverly Hills. Became a huge hit, running from 1990 until 2000. Perry left the series in 95, came back for the last two seasons. He appeared in numerous movies and TV shows since, including Jeremiah and The Fifth Element. Since 2016, he'd been starring as Archie Andrews' father, Fred, on the CW series Riverdale, inspired by the long-running Archie comics.
Yeah, he was doing great on that. I was watching that one.
Yeah, so dies from a massive stroke, complications from a massive stroke at the age of 52.
Right.
And I guess he was being kept comatose, even though, like I said, he was completely responsive immediately following when 911 was called. So it's really scary stuff. Fox announced on February 27th of this year that there will be a reboot of Beverly Hills 90210. With most of the original cast members. Perry was too busy with Riverdale to sign on as a regular, but was planning to make a guest appearance.
Well, now that's so weird because I knew him. He and I hung out a bit at the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival in Montreal, where he was a main stage host. You know, they always bring the big stars up to introduce the thing, and the gag went horribly wrong, where he was supposed to be a BMX bicyclist stunt guy, and so he put a helmet on, and then he biked down the aisle into the lobby, where a real BMX stunt guy was waiting, and then that guy biked up the other aisle and was supposed to do a ramp jump, and it worked great in rehearsal, but the stunt guy really flubbed it. And then everybody goes, "Oh my God, Luke Perry's hurt." And then he comes running down the aisle, takes off his helmet, and goes, "I'm okay, folks." Everybody's like, "Hooray." Okay, who hurt himself on stage now? What happened? Who's that guy? And unfortunately, the stunt guy was okay as well. But it was a just for laughs gag gone horribly wrong with Luke Perry.
Every time you tell me about stage gags go wrong, I think about that magician who set himself on fire.
Right? I've seen a lot of the stage gags go wrong.
What was that guy's name? I mean, a couple, maybe at X-Filers United, we're going to have to tell that story again. But what what was that guy's name again?
Leo Bassi.
Oh, God.
Italian
Leo. It's the greatest. You know, what did I call the X-Files episode? Best worst episode? That's the greatest awful story.
Awful.
Greatest awful story. Yep. Yeah. Ever.
Terrible.
All right.
Okay.
Back to British music, Dean's favorite category for 400.
Okay.
Keith Flint was the energetic frontman for British electronic dance group The Prodigy.
Oh, yeah.
They popularized underground UK dance music in the US. Now, that's an odd phrase, popularized underground.
Right. Yeah. Well, it was popular to go to underground clubs at the time.
I guess, yeah.
Isn't it still popular?
But then how is it underground? I don't know. Anyway, okay, so Flint's double mohawk, facial piercings, and heavy eyeliner made him an instantly recognizable figure in the 1990s. He originally joined the group as a dancer, but eventually recorded snarling vocals on the hit singles Firestarter and Breathe. The Prodigy's 97 album, The Fat of the Land, reached number one in the U.S. and the U.K., although his stage persona was dangerous, he was often described by people who met him as gentle and kind. Isn't that the way? By the way, you know, it's, again, apropos of me doing a spoken word piece about Shatner. You know, it comes up so often about like, oh my God, I love him so much. Is this role, isn't it a shame that he's a total jerk or a total asshole, right? Name the actor who's identified with heroic roles, and often you will meet an asshole or a jerk, right? And,
right.
And people will say, oh, isn't it a shame because he's so nice or so good on that. And it's like, no, at some point you have to acknowledge maybe they're capable of doing that because of who they are. Not in spite of it. And because we know the old adage about, and we've met many of these people who play villains. They're often the sweetest, most gentle, kindest people because they get that which is disowned, the darkness, the evilness. They have a healthy relationship to it, which is that they put it to use in service of these stories, and it frees them to explore all that is kind and gentle and loving in their personalities the rest of the time. So it's not surprising when these rock figures, these stage performers, whatever, who seem to be so scary are actually just sweethearts.
I know, right? It's as you say, you embrace your shadow before your shadow embraces you.
So he often spoke in interviews about his struggles with drug abuse and depression. He died by suicide at the age of 49.
Wow. Okay.
Ellie Mayday, born Ashley Luther, a Canadian model and an activist for body positivity and women's health. She received both a modeling contract and a diagnosis of ovarian cancer in 2013. She battled the disease for her entire modeling career, continuing to model after losing her hair to chemotherapy and undergoing surgery that left her with scars. She turned these visible signs of her cancer into badges of honor, inspiring others who fight the disease. She died in Vancouver at the age of 30.
Wow. That's something. I did not know of this person. Ellie Mayday.
Ellie Mayday, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Fantastic.
If I can't look count at what on we're learning. You to know about
to know my...
the Vancouver model scene.
I've been away for a few years. It's hard to keep up.
You were one of the most successful hand models in all of Vancouver Theater Sports League.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. They called on me.
The voice with a heart. Okay. Jan Michael Vincent, Dean Hagelin.
I know. How is this guy still alive?
I know. Isn't that, talk about a guy who felt like he died a long time ago. I mean, that's that. Right. And I feel like he almost did on a couple of occasions, right? I mean, so he was a heartthrob in the 70s and 80s. He starred on the CBS action series Airwolf, which is how a lot of people knew him, playing helicopter pilot Stringfellow Hawk, with an E at the end, from 1984 until 1987. But, I mean, in the 70s, he was a fixture in a lot of tough guy movies.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Co-starring with Charles Bronson in The Mechanic, which I watched not long ago.
Right.
As a fellow stuntman to Burt Reynolds in 1978's Hooper, which also I rewatched again fairly recently.
Okay.
And that same year in 78, the surf cult classic Big Wednesday.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I forgot about that.
One of his first starring roles was in Disney's 1973 movie, The World's Greatest Athlete.
Right.
He struggled with drug and alcohol problems that contributed to a career downfall after Airwolf. And I feel like really did affect the career even before Airwolf. But it always seemed like, I mean, this guy should have had... I mean, look, he's co-starring with Bronson and then Reynolds. I mean, he had looks. He was a bona fide tough guy and had the acting chops. And it just seemed like he should have had the industry by the balls.
Well, and this is some crew members said that, you know, he had everything. And somehow that may have been the contributing, that it was so easy that, you know, there's that thing every artist feels like they're a fraud sometimes. And I think he really embraced that. I know one of his, there's a terrible sci-fi movie that makes no sense called Extro 2 that friends of mine were in acting with him. And the producers made him give back the salary because he was so unable to perform that they often just propped him up against a wall with a prop gun and shot some footage just to say, Jan Michael Vincent in Extro 2. So, you know, it's tragic. It's tragic when that happens.
Yeah, when you ruin a movie called Extro 2, it's tragic.
It's tragic.
He died at the age only 73, actually. That's, you know, I mean, we're talking about some people who've died at 30 and 49 and 44. But 73 is not old.
Not old.
And of cardiac arrest in Asheville, North Carolina, Jan Michael Vincent. Strange to think that, if somebody asked you, is Jan Michael Vincent still alive, you really, until last week, wouldn't have known.
Wouldn't have known. And but it's also, you would think not, because of the sheer stories of the amount of abuse in terms of drugs and alcohol that he put his body through, to the point where he lost circulation in one of his legs and it was amputated for the last 5 to 10 years of his life,
well,
I think.
Well, he died in February, long before the news broke, too. So, you know, wow. Anyway, if Jan Michael Vincent dies at 73 in Asheville, North Carolina, does anybody hear the sound that it makes? It takes a while. It takes a little while.
It takes a while. Yeah.
Okay, finally, someone that we've been remiss in not discussing, but I wanted to make sure that we had time, because he was the last, Dean, as far as I can tell, the last living great director from Hollywood's golden age.
Oh.
And that's something. That gets your attention, doesn't it?
Right, yes, I'm listening. Who's this?
Stanley Donen.
Oh, yes.
Director
Stanley,
and choreographer.
Right.
Notable films include Singing in the Rain and Sherrod. He died of heart failure on February 21st at 94. I mean, maybe there are others, and I would love, I'm sure Maurice Terenzio is listening, and he might be able to, to point out, no, these people are still very much alive. And I would like that, but I have not been able to find any that fit this bill. The great Hollywood directors of the Golden Age still being alive. So, anyway, right. Look, he was a walking factotum on... not only filmmaking in general and Hollywood filmmaking in general, but the musical genre in particular, right? Which he was known best for. He was the driving force of a new style of movie musical, one that made singing and dancing an organic part of an evolving story rather than the highly staged and stylized in a backstage musical kind of format.
Right. Right.
But he wasn't a niche director, right? I mean, we've kind of talked about this and alluded to this before of if you can stage movie music, you can stage action. You can stage suspense. And indeed he did, right? He went on and did this. In addition to his musicals, he was also known for smart comedies. And again, how much of it all comes down to timing.
Right.
Which this guy had a wonderful, wonderful sense of. He had an early role dancing in a Broadway chorus, and that gave him his first break. It was in Pal Joey, and he met Gene Kelly, the rising star who would become his choreographing and directing partner and would help launch his career. They first worked together on 1944's Cover Girl, a Rita Hayworth, Gene Kelly musical, for which Donen choreographed three of the dance numbers. One of those dance numbers went down in movie musical history. In it, Gene Kelly dances with his own reflection in a shop window, with the reflection breaking free and becoming a dance partner.
Wow, that's an old classic split screen gag.
And of course, the obvious joke is that's the dance partner Gene Kelly always wanted. director Chiles Vidor considered the idea too technically challenging to work, so Kelly and Donen took over the scene, directing and filming it themselves. The result, after a massive amount of post-production, obviously, work done by Donen, was revolutionary. That scene, more than anything else, made Kelly a star and gave Donen the reputation as an innovator. As you would say, Dean, I should say so.
I should say so. Wow. That's pretty cool.
The two men paired again to choreograph the 1945 Kelly film Anchors Away, which Donen devised another unusual scene. It was in that one, Kelly's partner for the number was Jerry, the cartoon mouse of Tom and Jerry fame.
Yeah. And you watch that now, and it's still surprisingly... pretty accurate in terms of eye lines and movement, and just that I guess Jerry was drawn after the choreography was already set, but it syncs so well. It's phenomenal.
Donen again worked hard in post-production to perfect the combination of animation and live action, and the result in Hanna-Barbera's words, or in Joseph Barbera, Hanna-Barbera, he said, having attended the first screening of it, it blew the audience away. And again, you can understand why. If it still has a bit of an impact today, you can only imagine.
Yes.
Donen and Kelly had their first chance to direct a full movie musical together in 1949, and their On the Town became a big hit and a classic of the genre. I am not a fan. I was shockingly disappointed by this. I don't think this holds up well. But it was a big hit. And it was shot in part on location in New York, which was a big deal, right, in 1949. Think about that. That's the year The Third Man is shooting on location in Vienna. I mean, things are changing. This is an innovation, the location filming.
Right.
It included the popular song and dance number New York, New York. As I mentioned, it was a box office hit, and it was an Oscar winner for Best Score. It opened doors for Donen, who signed a contract with MGM and got the opportunity of a lifetime. a gig directing his childhood idol. Donnan had revered Fred Astaire since childhood when he saw him star alongside Ginger Rogers in 1933's Flying Down to Rio. And,
right.
And for Donnan's first solo outing as a director, he directed Astaire himself along with Jane Powell in 1951's Royal Wedding. The film was successful, fulfilled a dream for Donnan, who called Astaire my inspiration. A second solo directorial project followed in 1952 called Love is Better Than Ever, starring Elizabeth Taylor and Larry Parks. So I don't know that one, but I will say your first movie, you're directing Fred Astaire. Your second movie, you're directing Elizabeth Taylor. People have some faith in you.
Yeah, for sure.
Donnan and Kelly were back together again in 1952. They collaborated to co-direct and co-choreograph, obviously, probably the most famous movie musical of all time, Singing in the Rain. Donnan, for all the innovation and all these great stars that he had directed, he was 26 years old when he made this, his third film.
Wow.
Which still remains an all-time classic, right? After
it does.
All these decades
Absolutely.
Later.
And it's got energy. And you think, well, that's exactly what a young choreographer, filmmaker would bring. Because so many people who do choreography films that don't have a dance background, yeah, the camera goes in too close, so you don't actually see the dancing. If you look at Singing in the Rain, or even the one where all three of them are flipping over the furniture, I forget the musical number, what that one was called. But the camera stays kind of flat, and you see all the performers from head to toe, which is weird, because you think, oh, we need something close here, we got to get there. But it was phenomenal how to shoot dance numbers, you actually keep the camera kind of far back actually see the dancing.
Although, at the same time, that movie contains the title song, Singing in the Rain, right? Mm-hmm. Which is shot in a way that I think no musical number, certainly before or after, would be. And again, they both share great credit for this. Kelly, who was mm-hmm. sick as a dog doing this, you know, number again and again and again. But they both brought so much to making this scene so iconic. Kelly sings and dances, swinging his umbrella, swinging himself on light posts. The dancing is exuberant, right?
Right.
But Donnan's use of camera angles and attention to detail also serves to make this so unforgettable. He later explained in an interview the meticulous way they created the streetscape. For example, Kelly would always splash in puddles in very particular places. And so Donnan had to dig the cement out of the soundstage floor in order to make puddles so that they could get just the right amount of splash.
Wow.
To get the right amount of avalanche splash.
That's very specific.
Yeah, it's not just about where do we put the camera to capture the man, right? It's where do we really capture the impact and the exuberance and the energy, like you said, of it.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
After Singing in the Rain, Donnan and Kelly would work together again, but their friendship and professional relationship soured when they co-directed 1955's It's Always Fair Weather, and the rift remained for the rest of their lives. Upset by the dispute and disenchanted with MGM, Donnan moved on to other studios and became strictly a solo director. But that drama with Kelly didn't hurt his talent or his career at all. He was given another chance to work with his idol, Fred Astaire, in the 1957 musical Funny Face, starring Audrey Hepburn, which was a box office disappointment upon its initial release, but later became successful and profitable when it was re-released as Hepburn's career hit a new plateau. His time as a director of musicals was coming to a close, but not before he created two more lasting classics, The Pajama Game in 57 and Damn Yankees in 1958. So it's easy to really let Singing in the Rain cast the shadow. But again, like we say, no matter how much you recognize someone for one thing, damn if their contributions may not go much, much deeper than that. He largely turned to comedies in the 60s, including the fantastic 1963 hit Charade, starring Audrey Hepburn and Cary Grant. It was an homage to Alfred Hitchcock. As Donen told Audrey Hepburn's biographer, "I always wanted to make a movie like one of my favorites, North by Northwest. I searched for something with the same idiom of adventure, suspense, and humor." In 1967, Donen again worked with Hepburn, directing Two for the Road, which made great acclaim. Other later films included Bedazzled in 67.
Love that.
Yeah. The Little Prince, 1974, and Lucky Lady, 1975. His final film was a television movie made in 1999.
Wow.
Love Letters. He never won a competitive Oscar as a director. In 1998, he was presented with an honorary Academy Award in appreciation of a body of work marked by grace, elegance, wit, and visual innovation. His acceptance speech was one of the more memorable in the awards history. And at this point, since they no longer televise the honorary awards, it will probably maintain its status as one of the most memorable. He danced with his statuette while singing Cheek to Cheek.
Stanley. How adorable.
So we finally got that in. We are overtime.
Of course.
You can find every installment of this product of British Psychological Warfare Division specifications, your Chilpak Hollywood Hour, at chilpakhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. I don't think we need to list the links, do we? Everybody knows.
No, I think everybody knows. They got to know by now.
Yes.
If you don't know, just send us an email. chilpakhollywood@yahoo.com.
That's a good one. That's a good one. Yeah.
There you go.
We want to hear that.
That's a good one.
All right.
Yeah.
Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
Take care of that cold. I'm Dean Haglund.
Guests of your Chilpak Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.